welcome to Dankosky Quality Cinemas. For your comfort and convenience, a seat has been provided. Please go to the counter outside for snacks that'll contribute to your feeling of dizziness. If you experience problems with projection or sound, please know that the nearest person who can help is 106 miles away in Boston. There is a large greenish-brown smudge or blotch on the upper right part of the screen. We don't know what happened, but it will be there for the whole movie, and for many years to come. Please refrain from texting or talking or shopping on Amazon or watching videos of your nephews on your phone during the movie. This theater can be rented for meetings, birthdays, and anniversaries, although you would have to be a Satanist or something to want to do that. Please, please not biting the dancing bears or nutcrackers? Does that say nutcrackers? When the men is dead. Dead? On the sticky floor? I don't know what this means. The feature is about to begin. Enjoy the show. And now he's covered from head to toe with artificial butter. Colin McEnroe.
And I like it. I like the feeling of that. All right, so we're going to talk about movies. This is our fall movie spectacular. We're so excited. Sam Hatch from the Culture Dogs that are on WWUH on Sunday nights. He's here in studio with me.
Hello.
And then joining us from the studios in New York is David Edelstein, America's greatest living film critic, although next to him is somebody who could plausibly also make that claim.
And chopped liver.
That's A.O. Scott from the New York Times. David Edelstein, of course, from Fresh Air, from CBS Sunday Morning, and also from New York Magazine. I'm holding New York Magazine right now.
I just want to say here that I invited my esteemed colleague, Tony Scott, to be with me here because I often gas on with you alone, and I really needed a punching bag.
Well, let the punching begin. Hey, can we start with Captain Phillips? I just saw Captain Phillips, and I feel as though I'm seeing a movie that has some recent antecedents, sort of anyway, in Zero Dark Thirty and in Argo. I mean, there seems to be a genre of movies right now that are at least sort of about Americans running into people who don't like them very much. And in two cases, SEAL teams show up and vastly overpower their adversaries. And in some cases, in Argo and in Captain Phillips, a little effort is made to maybe present a little of the point of view of the underpowered adversaries. But David, I'll start off with you. I mean, are these movies linked in any way in your mind, or are they at least worth comparing to one another?
Well, yeah, I think there's more than a little effort in Captain Phillips, to be fair to it. I know there have been charges that the film is racist and caricatures the Somalis. And I think when you're in Somalia in the camp of the warlords, I could have used a little more subtlety. They sort of reminded me of scenes in a Sylvester Stallone movie. But I think since 9/11, a lot of movies have kind of preyed on the idea that we may have these illusory borders, but especially in an era of globalization. And Captain Phillips spells this out, you know, with placards, that we are increasingly vulnerable, and for pretty good reasons. I mean, Argo, it might be on our side, but there's an extraordinary prologue that essentially lays out the history of CIA interference, modern CIA interference in the internal affairs of Iran. And I think what's equally interesting about these movies is that they're all procedurals, that rather than taking a much more kind of imaginative view of, and I know that's going to be challenged, but they kind of go step by step through the process of somebody being captured and the minutiae of liberating them from whoever their captors are.
Tony Scott from the New York Times, react to that a little bit. His makes an interesting point, which is once you get into the thick of the procedural, once you're drawn along into the plot, it's hard to separate your rooting interest from any kind of geopolitical considerations.
Well, and I think that's a very frequently a tactic of movies that are dealing with thorny, controversial, upsetting, still live geopolitical issues. You know, you can go back to Black Hawk Down as another example of that, where you kind of suspend the questions, or all of the Iraq movies that were about, okay, this is about these soldiers in this place, in this fight, and we're not going to really think about or talk about or focus on the politics. So you can tell, you know, a story that's more implicitly or tangentially political than one that is directly that way. And I think that these movies handle it in different ways. I think that Captain Phillips, especially at the end, does something very interesting where, you know, you've been in a conventional, almost sort of Western movie scenario where you have the beleaguered underdogs who also have this enormous disproportionate military might behind them. You have the cavalry, basically. I mean, it's the U.S. Navy, but it's gonna change the equation and the proportions. But you have this sort of thing where the Americans are simultaneously the masters of the universe and the underdogs. And then right at the end, in Hanks's final scenes, I don't want to give too much away, but in some of the shots of this little lifeboat bobbing around in the water up against these enormous, not just the enormous Maersk Alabama container ship, but these enormous warships, you get a kind of queasy, dizzy sense of the way it looks from the other side, of what it looks like to stare down into the face of this enormous, implacable, impersonal power. And I think I give the movie a lot of credit for doing that and for showing that.
You know, Sam Hatch, first of all, if people want to call in and be part of this conversation, the number is 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. So there's this opening to the movie, which David Edelstein finds a little bit ham-fisted, where basically the warlords are showing up and saying, go out there and be a pirate and get me some more money or bad things are going to happen to you. But, you know, other than that, which is maybe a little bit ham-fisted and expository, as that movie unfolds, you know, there are subtle ways in which the points of view, as Tony Scott's saying, the point of view of the Somalis is at least kind of seen or sensed as a matter of scale. But I just wonder how much the average moviegoer sitting there with his popcorn and soda is able to process that as against this, let's get poor Captain Phillips, poor Tom Hanks back on the American boat and do something about these people.
I have to actually admit that I was going on assignment to see this film this weekend, and when I had to actually plunk down the money, I swapped at the last moment for Machete Kills. So I think Danny Trejo should have been injected into Captain Phillips, and then I would have a little bit more knowledge to speak thereon. But,
all right. We'll swing over to Machete
Kills.
I've
seen all the other Paul Greengrass films.
I think you ought to be ejected out of the studio for going to Machete Kills, especially if you'd seen the first Machete.
That's what made me want to see more.
That is one piece of crap. And, you know, the fact that it comes on like a piece of crap, like it knows it's a piece of crap, doesn't excuse it's a piece of crap.
I think that's what Sam likes about it.
That's what I love about it.
Mm-hmm. Our number 860.
But there's good crap and there's bad crap. Stop with the phone numbers. I want to get on. I want to say crap another time.
Okay. Do you want to explore that distinction even? Feel free.
Between good crap and bad crap,
yeah,
that's the story of my life. Yeah. What are you talking about? That's my business. Yeah. That's what I've made my reputation on.
We probably do not have the world in time to do that. Well, you know, just to go back to Captain Phillips for a second then, the other thing that I was sort of wondering as I was watching this is in a certain way, I mean, you guys see a lot more movies and you can probably come up with some other examples, but I suddenly realized I was watching one of the first movies that I've seen about a recent historical episode that was on President Obama's clock. And he doesn't really appear anywhere in the movie, but I would imagine I'm about to see quite a bit of landfall of that kind of movie now. I mean, we've seen a lot of movies about the Bush era. And this
Wait a minute. I just want to say that Obama should have played much more of a role in Zero Dark Thirty, being the executive who gave the go-ahead and
right.
put the hunt for Osama bin Laden. That's real good. back on the back burner. And, you know, the movie, Catherine Bigelow, when Tony was talking before, I was thinking she's the prime example of someone who takes politics and in some ways morality out of the equation and catches you up in the immediacy and the sort of fight or flight immediacy of the situation, which is maybe why I withhold the final accolade, not only because I can't pronounce accolade, but because I just think her movies don't have a fullness and a range. But I think that I forgot. I was paying tribute to something that he said, and I've forgotten what it is. What was I talking about that you just said?
That Tony just said?
Yeah. Never mind.
No, I'm only the second greatest living film critic, so it doesn't really matter.
No, you're still very important, though. Never forget that. If anything were to happen to him, you know, you would have to take over as America's
See, Tony is much more lucid because, you know, writing for the New York Times, he can't indulge himself in parentheticals the way I can. You see, I start a parenthetical and then I keep going and then I forget what the sentence is. And, you know, Tony has a, you know, is a much more judicious writer.
Well, I mean, just to go back to Zero Dark, Dark Thirty, for example, for a second, since you brought it up. I mean, that's a movie where I was sitting there and I was struggling towards the end because I know Osama bin Laden is legitimately an enemy and somebody who needed to be dealt with. On the other hand, the triumphalism of this, you know, massive contingent of SEAL team guys, you know, heavily armed, fully equipped with the element of surprise, with everything going for them, storming this compound in which there appeared to be almost nobody and the almost nobody certainly in no position to resist them, and then watching them kind of methodically go through and do what they needed to do. Although I sensed in the audience around me a spirit of triumph, I thought, well, there's something kind of fundamentally wrong with this. I mean, movies are traditionally about sort of the underpowered, overmatched little guy taking on somebody else, and this can never be that.
Well, I think it's a big problem in a way that faces you know, action movie makers and Hollywood and genre filmmaking of certain kinds in a post-Cold War world and in now a very, you know, 12 years on from 9/11 world, where the absence of a credible kind of eye level enemy. So you know, you had like movies that came out this year, like the first of the you know, Siege of the White House movies, mm-hmm. where, you know, it's a crack team of highly trained, lethal North Korean operatives, and you can't take that seriously just as a sentence. You know, it's like, oh, really? Come on. And that's sort of a problem that I think these procedural movies are trying to grapple with and deal with. It's like, how, you know, you have like what, a half dozen fishermen, you know, and how are we going to make this look like a not just a fair fight, but kind of an interesting, you know, outcome in doubt.
Well, there's an assumption there, though, which is that these people are willing to die and willing to sacrifice individual lives. And we carry around in us the image of the 9/11 hijackers, 19 men who were able to do and kill thousands and do incalculable damage. And that is what has dented our armor and has created the sort of climate for movies in which we see the White House repeatedly mm-hmm. taken out. It's interesting you mentioned White House Down, because in the other White House takeover, it was right-wing supremacists, you know, who took it over. So on one hand, you've got the
slightly more plausible, perhaps.
Well, let's not say that because they'll come after us.
Well, no, I actually do. As long as we're talking about this, I mean, I did think, when we can get back to that whole question too of Captain Phillips. Because I do think that's interesting, Captain Phillips, too, that Musay, the leader of this pirates, the first thing he says is, I'm not Al-Qaeda. We're not Al-Qaeda. We just want money. Mm-hmm. And he wants to make it clear right away. No, he's not planning to lay down his life or anything like that. That's not who
he
is.
We're capitalists just like you.
Yeah,
he's not dangerous.
He's not dangerous in that way. But, Sam, I know that you saw a lot of these this summer, a lot of these movies. And as I sort of processed those movies, White House Down, Olympus Has Fallen, I would throw in movies like World War Z where, mm-hmm. you know, in the first 10 minutes, the president's dead.
Yeah.
As opposed to Independence Day, where the president's still giving great speeches, you know, at the
amazing
end of the
speeches
at the end of the movie,
flying planes too. Don't forget.
Yeah.
And I sort of wondered whether, in some ways, we were being sort of psychologically softened up for the government shutdown somehow. That, you know,
yeah, World War Z really was the predecessor for that. Yeah, and it's to set us all up. And for all I know, I mean, there may be zombies raging around in other borders, other states beyond Connecticut. They may be here already, anyways. But yeah, absolutely. There's no help from the government, except for on that ship, on the ocean there. But it's all up to Brad Pitt.
Well, the subject of World War Z, interestingly, was that in a moment of total chaos, the UN would function, which is, I mean, the UN doesn't function in even average amounts of chaos.
It was, in fact, international NGOs, not only because wasn't it like a WHO facility that they went to in Wales? So the nation states have all collapsed. So really, World War Z, when you think about it, is the most insidious Agenda 21 world government black helicopter movie ever. And the zombie
thing trilateral
is just,
commission.
It's a pretext to get us all, you know, under the thumb of world government.
We're talking to A.O. Scott, David Edelstein, and Sam Hatch about the movies that are here and also the movies that are to come. We'll talk about that, too. We're looking for a few common threads running through them. Let's just go back to Captain Phillips for a second. We've got Donald from Bloomfield, who I think is in the business, as they say, not the movie business, the freighter business. Donald, do you sail the high seas?
No, I do not. I went to Maine Maritime Academy, though, so many of my friends and colleagues from there do.
And so what have you got to say about Captain Phillips?
Basically, the feeling in the industry is that he's portrayed as kind of the hero in this movie, but in actuality, he wasn't a hero at all.
I've heard this a lot lately.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Just for example, I think in the trailer, so I'm not spoiling anything, in the trailers he says, take me instead, which is not only something he didn't say, but a behavior that he didn't characterize either.
I wondered about that walking out of the movie. I think the first thing I said to my significant other is, I bet it's going to come out that he didn't say, shoot me, shoot me.
Worse than that, I mean, there have been charges, and I don't know if they're legitimate, because I wasn't there, that he steered the ship much too close to the Somali coastline, and that, you know, maybe because it was a shorter route, he actually put the ship and its personnel in danger.
And, you know, this has almost become a cottage industry. In Slate Magazine, your former home, they have a thing called Browbeat, and one of the functions of Browbeat, there's actually one person at Browbeat who I think mainly investigates the historical veracity of movies. It's like a job now. Yeah. And so there is 12 Years of Slave.
We have PolitiFact. We now have Pundit Fact. Yeah. There's no reason we shouldn't have Movie Fact.
It's also a staple of award season campaigning and counter campaigning to float up stories about how, you know, the truth, this movie doesn't tell the truth or is you know, to kind of muddy the water.
See, it's not for nothing that Harvey is in tight with the Clintons, because Harvey Weinstein is really the master, and the various genius publicists who work for him is a master of doing oppo research and, you know, getting it out there really, really efficiently.
Believe me, you're talking to the choir about this. We in Connecticut lived through. I had just done an interview on stage with Tony Kushner, whose company I enjoyed a lot, and he seemed like just a grand fellow in every possible way. Then he got into this horrible fight with one of our congressmen, Joe Courtney, about the fact that there's something really seriously historically wrong in Lincoln, a movie that Steven Spielberg insists on distributing to schools so that they can teach history. And Tony Kushner, among other things, accused Joe Courtney, who's a rather innocent fellow. I mean, I've known him for years. Apparently Ben Affleck had worked on some campaign of his years and years ago, and this was once in all of the ways that David is suggesting, you know, this was some kind of sand in the gears operation.
Nothing past them.
Right.
Nothing.
But, you know, on a semi-serious level, how important is it, and what standard do you hold movies to in that regard? I mean, you take a movie like JFK, where Oliver Stone is making a big deal out of the fact that he's going to set the historical record straight, and then he doesn't. And I feel like he needs to be held to maybe a different standard than somebody making a movie based on a real. I mean, how important is it one way or another whether Captain Phillips in real life is just a complete jerk, weasel?
We have an example. Tony and I were just talking before we sat down, and he can speak to this too, but Bill Condon is coming out tomorrow. The Fifth Estate is opening, the Julian Assange story. And he's hid behind, Bill Condon, the director, is hid behind, we don't have to tell the story as it happened. This is a movie. This is a fictional movie. Well, I'm sorry. It's a fictional movie that has the name Julian Assange, the name Bradley Manning, the name Daniel Berg, from whose point of view the movie is. And it's a takedown. It's whatever you say about the movie and whatever you think of Julian Assange. It's a reactionary takedown of not only what he did, but it seems to me of the idea that we need somebody like that, whistleblowers, as a kind of corrective to the culture of secrecy in which we're living.
I would put my critique of that movie, which I also don't like, in slightly different terms, which is that it's a failure of storytelling, partly. I mean, just that it tries to kind of go in so many directions, and in a way to sort of split the difference, to play it down the middle, to say, well, we approve of some of the things he wanted to do, but his personality had some problems and his methods were not so good. But I think often filmmakers try to have it both ways. I mean, going back again to Zero Dark Thirty, which is not a movie currently playing in theaters, but before that came out, Mark Bowl and Catherine Bigelow made a very big deal about how solidly reported it was, how journalistic, how accurate. And then when they began to be called out on some of the liberties it was taking, you know, fell back on the, well, it's a movie defense. And I think the, well, it's a movie defense is not a bad one. I mean, this is storytelling. These are fictional stories. And I think we can allow them a lot of latitude. But we have to think about how they're choosing to tell the story.
Yeah, they're backing away from what the message of their movie is, how Condon structures that movie. It's a story of disillusionment. It's a saga of disillusionment from the point of view of WikiLeaks' number two. And Condon can't back away from that. He can't say, well, he can't forswear responsibility, just the way he portrays Assange as taking no responsibility for the documents he was releasing. And Bigelow and Bolin were infuriating the way they said that their movie was straight down the middle, when it really selected and orchestrated events to not just suggest but depict the way torture, extreme interrogation led directly to the doorstep of Osama bin Laden. I'm tired of artists, you know, for one reason or another, and often this is where it comes back. This is where it comes back to the awards thing. Often it's when they're on the precipice of being nominated or receiving awards, you know, and they're furiously backpedaling from their own messages.
I have to say, sorry, go ahead.
Well, Sam, I just wanted to hear you on this, Sam. As you go to a movie, whether it's Lincoln, whether it's The Social Network, mm-hmm. whether it's one of the movies we're talking about, historical veracity, does it matter to you as a moviegoer, or do you just want to see a movie?
Yes and no. And Social Network is a prime example, because I'm a huge fan of David Fincher, and I love that film. I love so much about it, but I don't really believe that it delivered the essence of that story, that there's so much missing and so much that was misreported. And, yeah, on one hand, I always looked at things from the perspective that as if I enjoyed the film and had some sort of basis in history, that I would then seek out alternate information to kind of inform myself about the reality of the situation. But then the counterargument being that most people would not be interested in that, and they would take the film at face value as that was history. So I'm always on the fence on that situation.
See, panel in New York, I think the deepest ring of hell is reserved for movies that present themselves as the counterargument. To me, that's the real sin of JFK, mm-hmm. is that it says, okay, everything that you've been told is wrong.
This is the deal.
The deal, and then it's not the deal.
I think, though, I mean, to play a little bit of devil's advocate, I kind of love JFK, not as a historical argument, but as a feat of demented cinema.
Couldn't agree more with
and,
that.
And I think also that there's often in conversations like this an unstated condescension toward the audience. You know, that the danger is that people are going to see a movie with Tom Hanks in it or Jessica Chastain or Kevin Costner or whoever, and are going to think this is the truth. And I'm not sure that's – I think that a lot of audiences can, better than maybe we give them credit for, you know, tell the difference and can sort out the genres of fiction and nonfiction and kind of stage acting and whatever it is that these movies
yeah,
are.
Yeah, but it's our duty to call out some of these things. I mean, a film that I know
agree.
Tony loves, Lee Daniels' The Butler, pitches itself as a true story.
No, yet, it doesn't.
Yes, it
no,
does.
It doesn't.
It does. It says based on a true story before the credits come up.
Inspired by a true story. There's no way that anyone involved in or watching that movie believes that the son of the main character happened to be at the Greensboro sit-in, at the King assassination,
overestimating the audience here. The movie opens with this kid's mother being raped, and when his father dares to stick his head up and glare at the white master, he gets shot in the head. Now, of course, nothing like that happened, but the director, Lee Daniels, is basically a brute, and he wants to start off his story by sort of whamming you over the head. And, you know, I think he's dishonest. I think he's
I think there's no claim in that movie that, I mean, it's also signaled by the fact that the presidents of the United States are played by these actors who don't resemble them at all in these kind of stage makeup and doing these hammy. I mean, if you cast Williams as Dwight Eisenhower and John Cusack as Nixon, you're not aiming
this is a perverse,
for
ironic. interpretation.
It's not ironic at all.
You're like one of these auteurs who sees like a fake background during a car ride in Hitchcock and says it was, you know, deliberate in order to bring out the artifice.
Every
of the
movie that Lee Daniels has made
is terrible.
Has a camp theatrical and over the top theatrical camp element, and this one is no different.
All right,
see that, then you don't. You know, you're not seeing the thread that links his
film. I see it, and I hate it.
We do have to take a little break right now. When we come back, we'll sort of maybe switch gears a little bit, talk about a different kind of movie. Some of the movies that are sort of more character-driven, more about human beings. I want to talk specifically about Enough Said and how a movie like that can very easily disappear in the shuffle of the multiplex. And we're back. We're talking about movies. We are privileged to have with us from the New York Times, A.O. Scott, from New York Magazine, Fresh Air, and CBS Sunday Morning, David Edelstein, from the Culture Dogs Show, and WWUH, Sam Hatch. We've been talking kind of about historical blockbusters and big blockbusters. You know, I do want to talk a little bit about human scale movies. And you know, one movie that I was really looking forward to and quite enjoyed was Enough Said, which is stars James Gandolfini, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, and Catherine Keener. I never quite known how to pronounce the last name of the director. Nicole Holofcener? Holofcener? I don't know. New York guys, do you know how to say it?
Holofcener.
Holofcener. Liked her other work, too. You know, this is a movie around here in Hartford. I'm sure in New York it's making a different kind of splash. Around here in Hartford and in Connecticut, it plays like on one screen per market. It's not getting any kind of big ride, any kind of big release. I would have expected more just because, if nothing else, because obviously it's one of Gandolfini's last starring roles, if not his last. And it seems even here in the fall, which is supposed to be the time for the, you know, the kind of grown-up movies and stuff, there seems almost not room for a movie like this. What's your take on that? What's your take, even first of all, on Enough Said? What did you guys think of it?
Well, I think I can't speak for Tony, but I think he loved it, and
it's on the record. Yes,
it's on the record, and I loved it too. And I, in fact, she's one of my favorite, you know, working directors mm-hmm. right now because of her. Sort of weird off-kilter timing in the way she explores the various neuroses of women, you know, admittedly middle-class and upper-middle-class women. I love the movie. It's doing very well in New York, as mm-hmm. far as I can tell, and a lot of people are talking about it, and maybe it's a movie that needs word of mouth. The sad fact is that unless it's a horror picture, you know, somebody like, you know, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, as much as everybody knows her, or even James Gandolfini, can't open a movie mm-hmm. wide. That's how people in Hollywood think. And unfortunately, that's how the audience thinks.
I think that movie also entered, as any movie does at this time of year, a horrifically crowded marketplace. I mean, at the times we review, we have this policy, perhaps misguided and self-defeating policy, but a policy nonetheless of reviewing everything that opens on a New York screen for a week, and we're routinely in September, October, November, looking at weeks where we have 23, 25, 27 movies opening. Now, a lot of those are very small releases or really kind of lost leaders for digital, you know, iTunes or VOD platform releases. But there are so many movies week by week competing for the attention of the audience, in particular, in a way, competing for the attention of, at this time of year, the otherwise underserved kind of grown-up, more serious, more refined, whatever, audience. And not only movies. I mean, everyone, you know, this fall while these movies were opening, everyone was talking about the last episodes of Breaking Bad, the new season of Homeland. There's a lot of competition for the attention of people who might be going to this movie, and I think that sometimes hurts them, or sometimes they get a little lost in the shuffle.
I agree, and it's really kind of sad that Tony and I are full time critics. We get paid to do this, and probably, if I'm lucky, I can see 25% of the movies that get released in a given year, if I'm lucky. Because what are we talking now, 800 movies
a year?
It's
getting up around 800, yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. Sam, you see a lot of these. And, you know, another movie that kind of got lost in the shuffle that Tony's talking about, and I do want to say, as a reader of the physical New York Magazine and the physical New York Times, you know, I almost do kind of – I have a little Kremlinology that I do with the weekend section of the New York Times. It's like, oh, wow, the review, it's like on page 17. I wonder if that means it's just not that important a movie. You know, maybe I shouldn't even bother to read the review. It's just too far in here. But you know, another movie that sort of grown-ups were interested in to a certain degree, simply because grown-ups know the brand name Sam Hatch. They know the brand name Sam Hatch.
They do, of course.
They know the brand name Sam Hatch. And they know the brand name Ron Howard. They know that Ron Howard movie is going to be a certain kind of thing. Mm-hmm. That it's probably not going to fall below a certain floor, may not rise above a certain ceiling. But so a lot of people I know were looking forward to Rush. And New York guys, here in Connecticut, what you experience is, if a movie doesn't have a big weekend, you know, in very short order, it's playing only at 10 o'clock at night or only at 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah.
That's what happened to Rush almost immediately. I still haven't seen it for that reason, Sam, but what am I missing?
Yeah, it's funny. Ron Howard, I've kind of had a love and hate relationship with it. He's very workmanlike and down the middle, but every once in a while he's got some visual flair and mixes things up. I think, contrary to some of the other opinions I've read, that I felt this worked better off the track than it did on the track. He didn't really have much attention span to a lot of the racing scenes, and you're not going to be strapped into the seat of a Formula One racer for longer than 20 seconds at a clip. But I thought the relationship between Chris Hemsworth's character, James Hunt, and Daniel Brühl's character, Niki Lauda, that was what really kind of created the sparks of the film. And you could kind of compare it to Cinderella Man from a few years back, except he learned his lesson from demonizing Max Baer in that film and creating the final tension of the you know, the underdog defeating the big burly man who will kill you. In this case, Niki Lauda is, you know, really a capable driver, and so is James Hunt, and they're both equally antagonist and protagonist. There's no one hero of the film, so that's the most interesting fact of it. It wasn't marketed that way. It had Chris Hemsworth's face in full giant close up all over the poster, so I feel really bad for Daniel Brühl. But what I loved also about it was just the kind of the capturing the spirit of the mid-70s. You know, you get to go and hang out at Kurt Jurgen's house right before he plays Stromberg and The Spy Who Loved Me. That kind of stuff was just captured in the essence of, you know, a bunch of guys in a car just blown away from the fact that Niki Lauda is driving their little beater through the back, you know, back roads of Europe. So I thought that stuff really worked well.
You're saying a lot of names, though, that I don't recognize. And Tony Scott, just a few seconds ago, you talked about how hard it is even for James Gandolfini or Julia Louis-Dreyfus to open a movie. Is this what happened to Rush? Was it unable to open well just because nobody knew any of these names that he sang?
I guess so. It's sort of a puzzle, because it you know, coming before it opened, it looked like it had a lot going for it. You know, Ron Howard is a brand name director who has a pretty good track record, and I think this is actually one of his best movies. And it's sexy and it's fun and it's exciting and you're interested in the characters and there's a lot of just cool visual stuff. But I can't really say why it didn't take off. It may be that you know, nobody knew who the characters were or had a connection to the period, or race car driving just doesn't get people into movie theaters or what. But whatever it would have taken to sell this movie didn't really happen. It had great reviews, but that didn't seem to translate into a lot of people going to see it.
I think it's kind of sad that as critics, it's sad that we often talk about marketing. You know, we think this film was mismarketed. I mean, it really shouldn't be our job to, especially, you know, as fairly ignorant of the process by which these campaigns are put together. At the same time, we have to observe from our perches that Chris Hemsworth can't open a movie without a, you know, a Viking helmet on his head, and and unfortunately the movie wasn't pitched in any way that I think gave you enough of a handle on what it was going to be. You really had to be sitting there to understand it, and God, I really lament this. In a crowded marketplace, it couldn't get any, if you'll pardon the pun, traction.
And maybe you should be thinking about marketing, or have to think about marketing, particularly in an 800 movie per year environment, where the average person is not going to see a quarter of the movies, David. The average person is going to see maybe 10 movies, mm-hmm. And depend on marketing plus you to figure out what those 10 movies are going to be.
No, well, it's fine. Sorry.
I mean, I think we do think about it in a way that the more time I spend in this job and just sort of observing the ways of the movie industry, I mean, I you do realize that it's a very hard job to get a movie out to the audience that will respond to it. And it's a challenge because you look at any movie that isn't attached to a global pop culture brand, you know, whether it's a superhero or a previous movie franchise or an amusement park ride or Harry Potter, has a very hard time, has kind of an uphill climb, and has to really sort of thread the needle and get it just right to get you know a large share of the audience to pay attention.
But also
to it.
What's really sad is James Sheamus used to like to tell the story, former head of Focus Features and Ang Lee's partner for many years, used to tell the story about Life is Sweet, the Mike Lee movie, which opens in New York, gets great reviews, nobody's there. The thing becomes a hit the 10th week. Mm-hmm. It's in the theater.
Brokeback Mountain had to be open a really long time before people started watching
it. Yeah, I mean, word of mouth accumulates, but now real estate is so precious in most theaters. And there are so many people writing about, I can't believe this little cottage industry that's sprung up, combing over the grosses on Sunday night. You know, these are so-called journalists, and some of them are so-called critics, writing about the grosses, and people in Hollywood read this, and they're just poised to yank these films if they don't have that big opening weekend or to brand it a flop.
This raises another question, and I want to get to it because we'll run out of time. But, I mean, the antithesis to Rush is Gravity. Gravity had this amazing experience. And, you know, despite what Tony says, it's maybe there's a way in which it is attached to some kind of discernible franchise that people have an automatic set of responses to. But I don't know what that franchise is. Maybe it's Clue.
It doesn't, and in fact, it's an example. I think, in addition to being a very entertaining and interesting and satisfying movie, it was marketed very, very well. I mean, I think that it was successfully gotten over, and you know, it may have had advantages. I think that Sandra Bullock can open a movie.
Sandra Bullock in space,
huge movie star.
Sandra Bullock in space. Anybody will green light that.
And just the stuff about the 3D, and I think it was a movie. Just anecdotally, from you know people I know who are not in this line of work, it was a movie that crossed over to a lot of grown up people, say, who don't think they're interested in action movies or 3D or science fiction or all that kind of stuff. Were curious about it. Were drawn to it, and went to see it. And I think that was a movie that managed to kind of break out, you know, beyond whatever niche it might have belonged to and become a movie that a lot of people just from all different tastes and backgrounds decided that they really wanted to go see.
I would just say it's the bigger, better roller coaster. I think that it used the 3D technology and people, word of mouth and the reviews said this is going to be a bombardment and it's going to be a bombardment like you've never seen before. You are really going to be, you know, seized, but you are going to be in the middle of the action. And of course, it's buttressed with a very, very corny and, you know, religioso subtext. And I think it's no mystery to me it crossed over. It's a very, very commercial movie.
All right. Sam, what's your take on this?
Yeah, exactly the same thing. It was the roller coaster. And for once, it actually deserved the extra surcharge for the IMAX and the 3D. It got your money's worth on it. But then it was shot through with this, kind of syrupy personal tale of death and rebirth and kind of delivered that Sandra Bullock experience that anybody that's a major fan of her is going to go look for. And then, all of us lunk-headed guys that are going to go see, you know, things exploding and whatnot are going to get their fill of that as well.
I am in that small minority of people who found the movie mildly annoying, but I don't even want to talk about it because I know I'll be pilloried.
Uh-oh.
That's fine. I'm open to that.
Well, we should take a break.
My wife didn't like it, you know?
I mean, oh, good. Rachel and I. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I'm going to take a little quick break here. We'll come back. One of the things I want to ask these guys, too, what movies they're looking forward to. A lot of movies are coming out very soon. Obviously, the New York guys have already seen a few of them, but what's on the schedule right now? Of course, I am all excited. I've already watched the new Wes Anderson trailer 3 or 4 times.
more than just 2 hours long. So you want to be in love like the movies, but in the movies they're not in love at all. With a twinkle in their eyes, they're just saying their lines, and so we can't be in love
at the end of today's feature. Please put your 3D glasses in the bin so we can wipe them on our aprons and put them in little plastic bags for the next patron. Oh, and Madonna, please turn off your phone. Today's show was produced by Patrick Scahill, Betsy Kaplan, and me, with help from our interns Garrett Connolly and Neil Patrick Harris. The part of Bill Curry was played by Adam Sandberg. On tomorrow's show, The Nose salutes the house stenographer who was hauled off the floor for yelling about Freemasons. It's about time we got back to the old style of crazy. And now, back to our main feature.
Yes, and our main feature is talking about movies with A.O. Scott from the New York Times, David Edelstein from New York Magazine, Fresh Air, CBS Sunday Morning, Sam Hatch from The Culture Dog, Sunday nights on WWUH. So before we run out of time for this, and then we can all always circle back to other things, I did sort of, you know, I was kind of looking down the list here, and New York Magazine has a nice little guide to some of the David Edelstein's five most anticipated movies, two of which, Let the Fire Burn and Gravity, are already out.
Colin, that's such hack work. That's such make hack work. You have to write about
this. You're the greatest living hack, man.
Maybe so. I'm turning into that. You know, those are these things. I'm not going to blow my horn here or sound my integrity, but I'm often invited to come and talk about a season of movies that I haven't seen and what I'm looking forward to. I can't think of any worse way to go into a season than with all these prejudices formed before you see. I read so many comments in my stupid comic session. It's like a comic session. It's Comic Con nerds saying, oh, I have no interest in this movie, you know, because it's about so and so. And, you know, just clear your palate and go in and say, this is going to be the best Gilligan's Island episode I'll ever seen. This is going to be the best Stallone movie ever.
Well, can I bring up one of my prejudices? Because it does touch upon your very list itself, which is that Alexander Payne, a director who probably all of us have liked a lot, has a movie out called Nebraska, which is, I believe, in black and white.
Yes.
You know, I do. When I hear a movie is in black and white, I feel as though, you know, it's not that it has three strikes against it, but it's got one strike against it. I just saw Francis Ha by Noah Baumbach, which I didn't like. It's the first Noah Baumbach movie I've ever seen that I didn't like. I've liked all. I even like Kicking and Screaming. In fact, I love
Kicking. You liked Margot at the Wedding?
I liked it okay.
But I didn't like this. Man.
And
really?
And I feel as though when people go black and white, they're trying to do something. They're trying to make their Woody Allen movie, or they're trying to do something. It says something to me. And so now I'm worried about this Alexander Payne movie. I mean, already I'm thinking, what kind of potential?
Total Philistine.
All right, go ahead.
Black and white is gorgeous. Black and white, when properly used, is gorgeous. We have lost such a wonderful expressive tool when audiences swore off black and white.
And I think there's a little bit of a revival of it, partly because of the way it can be done digitally. That both of the films you mentioned were shot digitally and were able to, I think, recover and extend some of the beauties of black and white. I know I wish there were more black and white movies.
More
silent ones too.
Francis Ha and Tony liked it a lot better than I do, as he likes everything that this creep Noah Baumbach does.
He's a creep after my own heart.
Okay,
he's
well,
a creep I identify.
You know, I want to say it was very inspired by a lot of the new wave films of Truffaut and Godard. And if you go back and you look at the 400 Blows or Breathless, the cinematography, I mean, the starkness, it has such beauty. I mean, there's such a way that in black and white, you know, your compositions and your characters can seize the screen.
All right, so I'm a Philistine. I get that. But,
so now that we've beaten you into submission,
I knew that anyway that I was a Philistine. So I do want to know if there's anything that you're eagerly anticipating. Sam Hatch, you've already seen Machete Kills. What can possibly top that in between now and December 31st?
Nebraska's on my list as well. Secret Life of Walter Mitty is the one I think I'm looking forward to the most. Ben Stiller is actually a really good director, and even his comedies have an element that many other comedic directors just don't kind of have. And The Wolf of Wall Street I'm looking forward to, and I'm kind of tenuous on Old Boy, Spike Lee's remake there of the Korean film. But, of course, you can't throw a stone anywhere without touching Anchorman 2, The Legend Continues.
Right.
So I'll have to go see that.
We're all in agreement on that.
Well, let's go to the guys in New York. Now, David, you say you really kind of hate talking about movies or projecting out about movie seasons where you don't you haven't seen the movie and you don't know what's coming.
I haven't seen Nebraska. I think Tony has, right?
I've seen it, yeah.
And I'm sure he'll talk about it. But I have seen the Coen Brothers movie, which is very, very bleak. And the more I think about it, the greater it is. And the one I'm really looking forward to that I missed at the New York Film Festival is the new Spike Jonze film, Her, in which a man played by Joaquin Phoenix has an affair with essentially Siri on his phone. I believe that's the premise. I try not to learn too much
about
these things.
It's a pseudo Siri. Yeah.
But I think
an operating system.
And yeah. I feel that way, you know, on the basis of the fact that I've loved most of his movies. Not so much adaptation like everybody else, but certainly Where the Wild Things Are and being John Malkovich.
I mean, I've seen a handful of these movies. I did see the Spike Jonze movie Her, and I'm very, very much looking forward to writing about it and to other people seeing it.
Are you not allowed to say your opinion?
I don't like to necessarily scoop it, but
that makes
it's
sense.
There's nobody listening. Come on, what did you think?
Stick to your
I think it's
story.
Lovely. I think there are, it, but it's very I almost don't want to spoil it because it's such
you
a
hear that
a
Warner Brothers
strange
lovely
thing.
A.O. Scott, New York Times
to discover and the Coen Brothers movie too, which I've only seen once and I continue to be haunted by, and has terrific music in it, and a really an amazing performance. I think a real breakthrough by Oscar Isaac, who plays this folk singer in early 60s New York. I am really looking forward to, of course, The Wolf of Wall Street, and also American Hustle, the David O. Russell movie about,
me too.
About something, I don't know, app scam.
Any David O. Russell movie.
Sideburns, is, big fat ties.
Any David O. Russell movie, bad or good, is going to be an event. That's one prejudice I have that I'm going to stick to.
Yeah, and I'm the only person who's really excited, planning his life around the release of the Hotel Budapest, the new Wes Anderson movie.
That's not this year though, is it?
No, I don't think so. The trailer just went up today. I got very excited.
There's a local.
I can only think ahead a few weeks at a time. 2014 is.
I'm also really excited about
the future.
The Wicker Man final cut is coming to Hartford in about a week or two. So an old Thomas Hardy film.
The original Wicker Man?
The original one, yeah. They found an archival print in the Harvard Film Archives and then culled from sources all around the world. And now you can see Christopher Lee in his
kilt for longer. You know,
exactly.
A movie didn't need to be longer. whatever you think of The Wicker Man, it's sort of torturous enough at its cut length.
I saw it right before I was about to sign up to become a mailman, and it completely changed my mind. that movie saved my life.
I don't think
life.
We can top that.
Yeah. That movie saved my life. I don't care what you say about it. All right. If I bring up another thing, I'll fry the clock, so I just have to thank everybody. This has been really great. It's been fun. We should just do – you guys, you know, Scott and Edelstein, that should be a show somewhere. You guys just bickering. is amazing.
I just think he doesn't get it enough in real life except from his wife. So, you know, I have to do it professionally.
All right. Great.
I'm not going
to
touch that.
All right. Great to have you guys on. Great to have Sam Hatch from the Culture Dogs. So A.O. Scott from the New York Times, David Edelstein from so many places, New York Magazine, CBS Sunday Morning, Fresh Air. I need an extra lungful of breath just to name them all. We'll be back tomorrow with the nose. I know the panelists. I'm not sure of the topics. I'm gonna turn on all of my charms. Baby, 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 may I take you to a movie? Baby, 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 everything would be so groovy. Baby, 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 if I could take you to a movie. Baby, baby, I'd buy you popcorn and candy. Baby, 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 everything would be
Thank you for choosing Dankosky Quality Cinemas. I'm Kyone Wolf, and maybe after this we can get a drink and get to know each other a little? No? Okay. Exits are to the left and right of the screen and in the rear of the auditorium.